The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Hello, I'm Gene Pell. Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is the Honorable Orson Swindle III, a retired Lieutenant Colonel Marine Corps pilot who was shot down over North Vietnam November 11, 1966. He was flying his 205th mission in Vietnam. It was scheduled to be his final one, and in a tragic sense it was. Then Captain Swindle was captured by the North Vietnamese. For the next 2,305 days, more than 6 years, Swindle was in various prisoner of war camps, the victim of almost daily physical and mental abuse. He was finally freed in the general prisoner release in 1973. He would later hold senior positions in the Reagan administration, including a 5-year term as a member of the Federal Trade Commission. His story begins in 1937, when he was born in Georgia, and where he grew up in the small town of Camilla.
Well, we thought it was pretty big.
Now, well, at the time, it probably looked pretty big.
About 3,500 right? people. I think right. the diameter of the community was 1 mile right. wide. It's Camilla, Georgia.
What was life like growing up there then?
It was wonderful, you know, especially thinking back on it now, Gene. My father was enlisted in the Marine Corps at age 27 or 28, as I recall, for World War II. Made the landing on Iwo Jima. My mother and father were divorced during the war, and I was there in this small town. And when they divorced and went their separate ways, I decided that I'd live with my grandmother and great aunt. So I was raised in this small town by the TOLs, that I affectionately call them, the two old ladies.
You're known for saying "I won't" to a lot of things. Was that?
I guess it started. I guess it sort of started there, and I don't know where I got that from. My grandmother was sort of the matriarch, and she was a tough lady, and gave me so much. And my great aunt was my favorite person. She was of all people. She was a principal in a school, and had been teaching all of her life, and read books, and got me to love books. So I opted to live with them. And you know, growing up in a small town in South Georgia with all the bigotry that existed was not good. But on the other hand, it was a very simple life. We played sports every season. My class was 65 in number, and we just had our 50th anniversary reunion of our anniversary of our graduation. And it was just a unique experience. All the values that come from having your neighbor's parents watching over you, as well as your own grandparents, in my case, or parents, and the teachers at school making sure you did the right thing. We had a lot of values instilled in us by a lot of people, a community.
You stayed in the state to go to college. You went up to Georgia Tech.
Yes, sir.
And how did you get into the Marine Corps after that?
Mostly from having too good a time at Georgia Tech and not being an engineer and not knowing what I wanted to do. But I don't know. I had two fraternity brothers. I was an ATO at Georgia Tech and a lot of dear friends for life. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And my father had been in the Marine Corps, and I was a child like you of the war, and we knew everything about the war. As you recall, we marched across Europe with the troops and through the Pacific. And two of my friends were in the junior-senior year option of Naval ROTC, and they were Marine option. And they were good friends of mine, and they talked to me, and I didn't want to do ROTC the last 2 years because I didn't like it. But I decided I would go through the Marine Corps PLC program, Platoon Leaders Course, and I got my commission that way. And I understand you got a Marine in your family now.
That's great. That's great. And then on to flight school?
Actually, on a flight school, but with a short stay in Beaufort, South Carolina, Marine Corps Air Station, where I was an engineer by profession, MOS, as we call it. And I was there for a couple of years, and I had originally intended to go to flight school, but my wife-to-be, my former wife now, wasn't particularly interested in staying in the Marine Corps, and it was a two-year commitment, so I opted not to go when I got my commission. And then, of all places, they send me to Marine Air Station, and I'm seeing all my buddies taking off in these sleek looking jets and looking cool at happy hour. you know the
right,
bit.
Right.
And I opted to put in a request to go to flight school and struggle through flight school, and then came back to Beaufort in 1965 and started flying the F-8 Crusader.
Where was your first duty station?
First duty station would be Quantico initially. As you know, Marine officers go through basic school there, and that was 1959 and the summer of 59. And then 8 months there, whatever, the 8 or 9 months, I guess it was, and I was assigned to Beaufort, South Carolina, Marine Corps Station there, which is right next to where Parris Island is. Most people would know Parris Island, not Beaufort. And from there, I went to Pensacola to go to flight school. And back in those days, you went to Pensacola, you went to Meridian, you went to Kingsville, and then you went, you know, all over the place to get your wings, the different phases of training. And then I was reassigned back to Beaufort to the base that I had left and the command that I had left.
When did you go the first time to Nam?
I only went one time. It was just a long time. I was in a fighter squadron. We were assembled to go as a unit to Japan to fill a air defense role that the Marine Corps had, flying out of Iwakuni, Japan, starting February 1st of 1966. And we assembled a squadron in December of 1964. And we stayed together throughout 65, did a lot of training, and then Vietnam started heating up. And in late 65, we were advised by Headquarters Marine Corps that we should start adjusting our training to accommodate combat in Vietnam, primarily in the close air support role. So that meant hanging bomb racks on our airplanes and starting to drop bombs and becoming proficient at that. We rotated as a squadron to Vietnam, to Da Nang. We went out to, I think we all assembled after Christmas holidays toward the end of January in El Toro, California. And the squadron en masse, about 300 of us, 350 of us, were flown by Air Force KC-135s or C-135s to Da Nang and start operations on the 1st of February. And I flew in excess of 200 missions over the next 7 or 8 months until I was taken out of the squadron at the end of August. I think I'd flown about 185 missions. Was assigned to a job in air operations over the, our wing headquarters, which was the lower. We have squadrons, groups, and wings, a little bit different than the Air Force does. And I was flying with my squadron, the only F-8 squadron in country, until it left country on the 15th of November, if I remember correctly. And I flew about 20 missions, and the mission I got shot down on November the 11th of 1966 was the last mission that I could have flown before I would come home. So I got smoked on this mission, and the only reason I was able to fly it is I had the duty on the Marine Corps birthday, which is November the 10th. Thus, I was very sober and rested, and they needed somebody to fly, and I had requested to fly, so I went off on this mission and got shot down. And
well, 205 missions, an yes. Awfully high number.
Well, you know, Marine missions are not the missions. We all do different things. We flew a lot of close air support missions in South Vietnam with Marines, flying in support of Marines. Mm-hmm. We didn't do a lot of interdiction stuff, but I think I flew maybe 45 or 50 or so missions over North Vietnam and Northern Laos. You know, you talked to a Navy pilot flying off a carrier, flying Alpha Strikes over Hanoi, and he might not have flown 200 missions, but 100, but his 100 were about 5 times worse than my 200. So, and the Air Force the same way. They flew the, you know, downtown Hanoi, and quite a different mission, but you can still get shot down on the ones that I flew, which I very nicely approved.
What brought you down?
Triple aircraft. They had shot two Air Force F-4s down early in the day. I heard later that they shot up an A-6 pretty badly and seemed like an A-1 that day. Got about 6 airplanes. The two F-4s went down where I did, and I went down. So they captured 4 pilots. One of the pilots in the Air Force F-4s, they had 2 in each, was killed apparently. And, I was lucky to survive, as were the other guys, and we would eventually be put together as we marched or walked up to Hanoi, and we carried in trucks, and they kept us separated the entire time. We started that journey probably maybe around the 15th of November and got to Hanoi somewhere around the 18th of December, as I recall, and by the time we got there, we pretty well had it. I mean, we were beaten badly and emaciated and sick and just we were a miserable wreck. We'd been through a lot.
Were you captured immediately on hitting the ground?
Yes. I was coming down the chute. I was hit pulling out of a bomb run. The aircraft pitched up very violently. And as you know, these airplanes sort of driven by hydraulics in those days. I guess they do it by electronics today maybe, but the flight control to control by hydraulics. And my aircraft pitched up very abruptly, nose high, and then decided it wanted to go straight down and went right over the top, throwing me up into the canopy, and I'm strapped in, but the G-forces are so high, negative G-forces, it pushes me out away from the seat. So it stabilizes in about a 70-degree nose-down attitude. My low altitude coming out of the bomb run was probably about 1,900 feet, if I remember correctly, and I had only been in the recovery just a few seconds, so it might have gone nose over, maybe at 3,500 feet, and all of a sudden there I was going 500 miles an hour in a very steep nose-down attitude, and made efforts to operate the flight controls, and they wouldn't work. And I had no choice but to jump out of the airplane, and I ejected going at a great rate. I was immediately open. All of a sudden I go from all this vibration and chaos into a chute where everything is quiet except for the whiz of bullets coming at me, and they were whizzing by me, and I took off my helmet and my oxygen mask and dropped that appropriately, and here I am, I don't know, 1,000 feet, and I'm slowly settling down, and below me is hundreds of people shooting at me in pitchforks and machetes, and it was not a pleasant thought.
Continue the chronicle of Lieutenant Colonel retired Orson Swindle after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. This center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Orson Swindle, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, who was shot down over North Vietnam and spent more than 6 years in captivity. After his capture, Swindle and three other U.S. pilots downed that day were taken north to the notorious Hanoi Hilton prison facility.
The trip up to Hanoi, I was shot down just across the DMZ, so about as far as you can travel to Hanoi, and I got there in the middle of the night. We had been tortured badly in the trip up and beaten badly, and we got out of that big 6x truck, and three guys were with me, and we couldn't talk. Every time we talked, they'd beat us. But we managed to grab each other's hand and hold it and said, "I'll see you, take care," or something like that. And I did not see them again until we came home. We were never in the same camp, and I was separated from them. Of course, as I got into the communication system, I was forever asking questions about Bob Biss and Ben Reinsdorf and Harry Mohn Lux, and And I'd hear stories about them from time to time. They're okay. Sadly, Ben and Harry both have passed away, and Bob Biss and I, the two remaining from that ordeal. But the Hanover Hilton was a very abrupt change in lifestyle, to say the least. It was abusive, demoralizing beyond belief, emaciating, painful. You know, I could sit here and rattle off a lot of adjectives. It was not fun.
When you got there, was Admiral Stockdale already there?
Yes.
Now Admiral Stockdale?
He was in Commander Stockdale.
Commander
Stockdale. James Bond Stockdale. When I heard his name, I said, what? James Bond, my imagination started just running wild.
So there
wild.
Was already a system and structure in place.
Thanks to him and his leadership, we were kept either in isolation, living alone, solo, as we'd call it, in a cell. And the cells were concrete block rooms, you know, with no windows. What windows there were boarded up. But they were concrete block cells, a big, heavy, iron, thick wood door. And we communicated by tapping through the walls. Some of the early POWs, I think Captain Smitty Harris is given credit for remembering the tap code that had been given to the Air Force guys going through training at State Air Force Base many years before. And it was a code that prisoners in Sing Sing or Alcatraz, as the story goes, invented. And he spread that around. And every time a new guy was shot down, somebody was trying to get that code to him. We would take toilet tissue they gave us, which is crude paper, looked like paper bag paper. And we'd make ink out of dirt and cigarette ashes and use a piece of bamboo as a stylus with a water, and we'd write the tap code out on that, fold it up in a little note and stick it in the rice when we went out to pick up the rice that we were fed twice a day in hopes that somebody who wasn't in the system would pick it up, find it, and start figuring out how to use it. And we all came to know the code and depend on it, and communication was literally our lifeblood. But Jim Stockdale was a relatively early shoot down, but before him was Jerry Denton. Admiral Jerry Denton, probably one of the greatest of all the leaders, Robbie Reisner, Air Force Colonel, who was just a remarkable man. Major Larry Guarino was one of the senior officers early on. And as every one of these guys are just incredible heroes. We ought to be talking about them, you know. Bob Shoemaker, who lives outside of town here in Washington, D.C., and Ray Vodin and Scotty Morgan and Bob Peel and Ron Storrs, who later I would live with, and Ron unfortunately died in prison. But they all just clung together in this isolated way. There might be one or two of them living together, or maybe as many as four, but most often they were living alone. And the Vietnamese knew to separate the senior officers away from the junior officers because of the leadership thing. But what they didn't understand, it was just intuitive to us. We'd been trained to do that. We all took up the leadership banner, whatever our role was. If we were senior, we were leaders. Mm-hmm. And they built into themselves this reliance upon each other, the communication system, the code of conduct, the idea that we're going to resist and we're going to fight as fiercely as we can. The battlefield is here. We're at war. And thanks to the leaders, like I said, Bob Shoemaker and Admiral Stockdale and Jerry Denton and Robbie Reisner and Larry Guarino and just a whole series of these kind of remarkable men, and the numbers would increase as we go along. You know, Admiral Billy Lawrence, who passed away this past year, as did Jim Stockdale. Just they carried us. They carried us by their own force of their own personality, and we weren't so bad at it ourselves. You know, we junior officers, we hung in there too, and we contributed a lot to it.
Sky.
return, Orson Swindle discusses his many years as a prisoner of the North Vietnamese, and how after so long, he and his fellow inmates finally got the word they would be going home at last. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
This is Jim Roberts, president of the American Veterans Center. I hope you are enjoying this episode of Veterans Chronicle. This program and all our programs are fully devoted to spotlighting America's military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan. All of these programs are completely sponsored through the charitable donations of individuals like you. If you share our belief that America's men and women in uniform deserve to have their stories of valor told, contribute to our mission by calling 571-480-4152 or by visiting AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Thank you for your support and enjoy the rest of the show.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get
gentlemen,
out.
This is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the Fuhrer's face.
We'll have the ammunition and we'll all
cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
During his 2,305 days of captivity in North Vietnamese prison camps, Orson Swindle and his fellow prisoners were frequently subjected to cruel physical and mental torture. It was not constant, but ebbed and flowed with the currents of negotiations and events of the war itself.
We often said it depended on where the bomb raids were. You know, if we were pounding them real hard with bombing, they were pounding us real hard. They wanted to use us, you know, obviously they wanted to get the military information, but, you know, after a prisoner of war has been sitting in a can for a few days, he doesn't know anything that's current, so the value of that is almost ridiculous. But they wanted to use us for propaganda, as we all know from the Korean experience, the communist was a new thing for us, and they used propaganda and used prisoners for propaganda and so forth. We had been so well, I think, taught by that experience in Korea that we were more educated. We basically were mostly all college students or college graduates. You know, the education level was remarkable. All officers for the most part, we had three or four enlisted up north with us. And I'm speaking now, I want to make this point, I'm speaking only of the experience of me up north. The guys who were captain in the south were mostly enlisted. They went through absolute hell. Mm-hmm. I mean, they lived in jungles and caves, and, you know, they suffered disease like we didn't. We were probably tortured more than they were from what accounts I've read. But, my God, they went through just – I couldn't have survived it. I don't think I could have survived it.
Mm-hmm.
But, anyway, the treatment, we didn't get enough to eat. I got down to – it was estimated by the guys that lived with me that I was maybe down to 120, 130 pounds by the summer of 1969 rolled around, 3 years after I'd been shot down. And I weighed about 195 when I got shot down, and I weigh about, unfortunately, I don't want to mention my weight now. I'm getting that 69-year-old weight carriage right now, but I'm still a pretty tough guy, but I'm not as good a shape as I used to be. But we were poorly fed. We never got out in the sun. I went from the time I went into the prison system, Henry Hilton, in mid-December of 66, I didn't see the sun directly until March 31st, 1968. And I remember it was when the Paris talks started and the bombing ceased up north. Remember Lyndon Johnson stopped the bombing then? And they took me out to bathe. I had bathed, but they would never let me out in the sun. And it would always be early in the morning or late at night. And I was out there in the sun, and I remember how it burned. It seemed to burn. My skin was so unaccustomed to it. But we didn't bathe very often. We were filthy. We had disease. We had boils. And then there was just the abuse. There was the propaganda that was constantly being piped into our cells, but the torture would come and go.
Were you able ever to get anything from home in way of a package or anything like that?
My family, I was listed as presumed captured, but missing in action. And my family didn't know I was alive until a young man by the name of Doug Hegdahl came home, and I think that was in 69. And Doug Hegdahl was a young enlisted guy who went to sleep on the fantail of a destroyer escort out in the bay at the Gulf of Tonkin and rolled off the back end of the ship at night when he was sleeping to keep cool and got captured. And Doug wound up living in a prison cell in a camp with a Navy commander then, Dick Stratton, who's one of the brightest people you'll ever meet. Dick Stratton he's a character. He's an Irishman through and through, and just brilliant. And Dick, and here's highly educated Dick, and here's Doug Hegdahl, who doesn't have a lot of education, but he's a smart guy, and they wind up living together, and they come up with all these stunts to pull. And there came a time after they had released six or nine, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure the number, American pilots, much to our chagrin. That was a no-no. You don't go home for the guys who were shot down before you. And then you only go home under honorable conditions. But they went home. They accepted early release. And so Dick and the ones in this camp had the wisdom to say, they're going to release somebody else. We know that our people back home don't know that a lot of us are alive. And as long as they're going to release somebody, why don't we groom Doug Hegdahl, an enlisted man, who they think they can maneuver. And they couldn't come close to maneuvering. Doug's a great guy. And he played dumb, and they went right along with it. And Dick would sit there with Doug, and Doug would memorize the names of all of us, which was one of the things we did to keep our brains going. But it was also, we knew that in Korea, we weren't sure we got everybody back. We knew that the Vietnamese held Frenchmen back, and we were going to make damn sure that if anybody was there alive, he was going to be known by all of us, and it was our duty to remember who was there so we could account for people. So Doug and Rich Stratton go through this process of memorizing the names, and Doug remembers all these names. And sure enough, they offer him early release, and the senior officers in that camp said, you go home, don't you do anything for them. Don't be a tool of propaganda. Just be the same ignorant seaman that you are. He's such a great guy. And he went home, and that's the way a lot of our families learned that we were alive. So I got my first letter from home in December of 1969, right after the Sontay raid. I was at Sontay. Special Forces tried to get us out of there, and they moved us all back into Hanoi. And that scared the Vietnamese that we could send 80 or 100 commandos 20 miles from Hanoi and almost rescue a bunch of POWs. And they gave some of us letters in. The letter was 2 years old, as I recall. I had a picture of my son. My son was four when I left home. He just turned four when I left home, and just turned 11 when I came home. And that was the first letter I received. I was allowed to write maybe six or seven letters, if I remember correctly, over the next couple of years. And I got maybe three or four letters during the whole time.
How did you learn that you were actually going to be coming home?
A whole sequence of events, the bombings of Hanoi in December. And, Richard Nixon turned them loose, and they absolutely, the only time I ever saw the morale of the Vietnamese ever wane was during those bombings in December of 1972. The guards were crying outside of our cell blocks, saying, Namui Hai, Namui Hai, and moaning, Namui Hai being words 52, I think, in Vietnamese. When the bombing stopped, we had some guards, a couple of guards, that I was never around, but I was told later, that these guards were young kids at another camp, and they were halfway decent. They didn't relish abusing people, and they never did. And when they started the real abusive stuff in 1969 and 70, they took these guards away from there because one of them cried at a beating. And they showed back up in January of 73 in the camp. And several guys recognized them. They came around. One of them, we had names for all of them, rat, snake, pig. This kid was named was Happy, so give you an idea. He was a halfway decent kid, I guess. And he came around, and he didn't speak good English, but he was saying things that made people think, something's going on. The bombing stopped, and then when we different. The propaganda sort of changed. And then about mid-January, it would be after. The agreements were signed, I think, on the 27th of January, if I remember correctly, 24th or 27th of January of 1973. And shortly after that happened, like a day or two, it was a cloudy, overcast day, and we heard a C-130 sounds like North airplane. You know it's a C-130. And we hear this C-130, and out of the clouds comes this gray C-130. It's like a ghost ship coming out of the fog bank. And so we know something's up now, obviously. And then a few days after the signing of the agreements, we were called out into an assembly in a formation in the courtyard, which was we were never allowed to use our rank. If you use your rank, they beat you. They went out of their way to say we had no privileges, prisoners of war. We were not prisoners of war. We were criminals. It was not a formal act of war. We had no rank, so forth. They came in and told us to come out and get in formation with our senior officer in front of them, which, you know, that was pretty astounding because it was a complete departure from 8 years of practice. We had all seen, and we're suspicious that, I mean, the C-130s did giveaway, so we think something's going on. We may not have seen the C-130 before we had this formation. That was probably afterwards. But we hear enough to know that something has happened. And they call us out there, and before we went out for this formation, we had all seen enough of their propaganda films to know that they exploit every opportunity, and we saw foot after foot of film they took of the French, from close-up cameras, but many times cameras far away from the French, where the French soldiers didn't know they were taking pictures, and they were all jubilant and hugging and everything, and when apparently they were told they were going home. And we had talked all this through, said, you know, we said we want to go out of here and date a shoot down, sick and wounded first. We'll go out in order of shoot down, and we'll show no emotion, and we're not going to be used like the French soldiers were in that propaganda thing. So we went out. We had prepared for this. At this point in time, I'm in a room with about 40 guys. They'd moved us all back in from Santé, so they couldn't keep us isolated. They had put about 40 of us in a single cell block. We were sleeping shoulder to shoulder. I think we figured at one time we each had about 18 inches of shoulder room to sleep, so pretty crowded. And so they called us out, and we went out, stoic as we could be, and they, with English, they got up and read the presentation of what the agreement said, and we stood there in formation, our senior officer out front, and we could see off in the distance what appeared to be a light reflecting off of lenses or something, so we figured the cameras were rolling, and the Vietnamese senior officer looked at us. And we showed no emotion. We just stood there. And he looked at our senior officers, and he says, did you understand? And the senior officer, I've forgotten who our senior officer, said, yes, we understand. Well, you have no comment? No. Is that all? And he said, yes, go back to your room. So we very casually, militarily walked back in the room, and as soon as the doors were shut, more than one of us was biting our knuckles to keep from screaming. You know? And then within a few days, I think that's when we saw the C-130 come in. And then pretty soon parts of that international force came in, and a couple of U.S. Army soldiers, interpreters were with them. And they came into our cell block, and there were 40 of us in there, and they walked around and talked to us individually and said, you know, you'll be out of here soon. And then we came out in order shoot down, sick and wounded first, just like we had said we would. And we knew that's what our government would want us to do, and that's what they asked for, so that's the way it happened. And, you know, we came out in that sequence. I came out in early March. My birthday's March the 8th, so I was released on March the 4th when we got to the Philippines. I back up just a second. We were driven from the Hanoi Hilton in a bus with no blindfolds for the first time. We drove all through Hanoi going out to the airfield. And, you know, people knew who we were. They were lined up on the streets. And we got out there and we parked behind a hangar. And we saw this C-141 coming in, which was just the damnedest feeling you can imagine. And then we were lined up in formation, and the exchange officer, in my case, it was an Air Force general by the name of Ogan. He was a brigadier general. and his Vietnamese counterpart. They call my name. They call each one of us in sequence by I guess we were lined up alphabetically. And I walked up and saluted him. He saluted me, and he said, "That young man will take you to that airplane." And a young lieutenant in the Air Force named Sylvester walked me out to the airplane, and I got there, and there was an Air Force colonel at the bottom of the ramp. He said, "Are you the Marine?" There were only about 9 Marines in this group. And he said, "Are you the Marine?" I said, "Yes, sir." "You were the friend of yours up there." And I looked up there, and there's my next-door neighbor from Beaufort, South Carolina, who gave me the first set of Navy wings I ever had. They were his original wings. He gave them to me when I went through flight school. And we're dear friends today. In fact, this summer, every summer we go down and spend a week with him down in Pensacola, Florida. A guy named Jim Harrison. I went back in early 93, the Clinton administration, after they'd been taken office, they put together a group of people with Secretary of State, retired, Ed Muskie. And they had me and Mark Salter. Mark is the chief of staff for John McCain, and of course John and I are very close friends, and had me, and I'd been, in 92, I'd been Perot's spokesperson, so I was fairly well known, and they sent us along with all these Democrats, and, you know, like, was there any bait what they were going to do? I happen to believe we should normalize relations, because, you know, got to get over this stuff and find out ways to win, you know, win the hearts and minds in other ways, instead of shooting people. But I went back to Hanoi then, and went to Hanoi for a day and do 2 days, and then to Saigon for 2 days, and then came home. It was interesting. I went back to the prison and walked and looked in the first room I was taken into in the Hanoi Hilton, and it was a horrible room, and I went through a horrible time there, and I looked in there, and all it was now was a storage room for old bicycles. A lot of history went through there.
Our thanks to the Honorable Orson Swindle for sharing his experiences as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.